This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. I'd like you to take a deep breath. Go ahead. Smell whatever it is that's in the air. Dinner cooking, the office air conditioning, that cup of coffee in front of you, the diesel fumes from the car ahead of you, or even the person next to you. Go ahead. Take a whiff. I'll wait. Okay. That odor is now registered on a small yellowish patch high in your nostril. Later, try to describe that smell to someone else who's never smelled what you just did. We'll reach for words, metaphors. We'll say it smells like, we even do the same to describe taste. Well, it tastes a little like chicken. Describing how our senses work and how our senses work us is Diane Ackerman's quest in her book, The Natural History of the Senses. She's a poet who also writes for The New Yorker about nature. Her other writings describe learning to fly and the beauties of the solar system. One of the challenges for naturalists who write is to convey their vivid experience across a page to the reader. I asked Diane Ackerman how she tried to describe smells for her natural history.
It's very difficult to describe smells. That's been one of the greatest challenges to literary writers. And we have lots of visual words with which we describe what we see, but we don't have precise words for many of the smells that we take for granted. It would be lovely if we had a word for the smell of a top of an infant's head, for instance, which smells so talky and untampered with by life. We don't have that. I know from my experience as a nature writer that there are various smells like penguin smells that are profoundly and undilutedly penguin, but we don't really have a word that we assign to it.
Well, in part to call it penguininity or something like that, I mean, means that other people would have to know what penguins smell
they
like
would,
as
that's
well.
That's true. They would have to know that. Or you could say something like penguinine, which sounds like a mountain range. Or you could say pinguid, which means kind of fatty, which wouldn't be correct either. Somehow we just haven't been relaxed enough and jubilant enough to want to go out and make a wonderful map of the smells of the world. We don't even really have a casual word for what happens when people lose their sense of smell. We have a formal word. We say that somebody without a sense of smell is suffering from anosmia. But we don't say that that person is something like smum. We should have a word for it that would normalize them more so that they wouldn't feel so freakish.
Well, then there are words that replicate themselves through the senses, like apricot is both a color and a taste. It's also a smell and also a sight.
Yes, that's true. And, of course, people who are willing synesthetes, that is, people who look at a color and think of a smell and manage to get their senses to do double and triple and quadruple and quintuple duty for one another, very often use a word like apricot when they hear a sound. So there are ways to make some of the sensory words double up in a pinch.
What is the term for people who have... Who mix the senses, who combine them?
This is a synesthesia. The people who do it are synesthetes. Some people are willing synesthetes. An awful lot of artists have been, especially composers. Very often composers have said that they would hear a note and think of a color. And the curious thing is that the colors that the composers associated with notes tended to be very similar. So it just seems like there are certain parts of the brain in which the wiring is a tiny bit cozier in some people than it is in others.
Is this something further down the evolutionary line or earlier in human history?
My guess is that it's earlier. Newborn babies always are confusing such things as smells and sights. They really haven't progressed to that categorical, analytical wonderland in which we tend to live as adults, and everything is a beautiful Niagara of smell and song and sky and mother.
My guest is Diane Ackerman. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and has written several books of poetry. She has a new best-selling book called A Natural History of the Senses. As a poet, you like to work with words. They're your tools, and you certainly have lots of words to work with in describing the senses. But some of your work has also included writings on flying, teaching yourself to fly. And you seem to revel in the jargon, the nomenclature of activities.
I guess I do. It's wonderful that you could use something as intrinsically neutral as a word and have that word conjure up a complete arena of emotion and circumstance. Let me give you an example. You mentioned flying. Yes, I I wrote a book called On Extended Wings about flying and what that teaches you about the world. One day I was learning to fly, and I was flying over Richmond, Virginia. When you leave an airport, you have to address an air traffic controller whose name is Departure. And you say, Departure, I am with you. And when I said that, my eyes suddenly teared up because I realized that in a much more profound and elaborate sense, Departure is always with us. Death is always with us. But it's curious to have to say it in this disembodied way to a voice over the airways, like an Old Testament God speaking to you in your aircraft, someone you will never see by face. It's just jargon to most pilots, of course, but there are a couple of ways to look at such words.
One of the bits of jargon is a navigation mnemonic. True virgins make dull company.
Yes, that has to do with charting your course across the landscape, and most pilots have traditionally been men, and so, of course, there's all kinds of frisky language like that that they use to remember things by.
As a poet or as a pilot, did you ever want to change it?
I don't think so. I'll tell you what I did want to do. There are intersections in the sky that have five letters to each intersection, so there could be Heidi as an intersection. And I thought it would be fun to go across the country renaming them so that they would better reflect what was taking place underneath them. All of the ones over Williamsburg, Virginia would have a colonial theme to them. All of the ones around Cape Canaveral would have an astronomical theme. I just thought that would be an interesting thing to do. I never did get permission to do it, although I have been just a tiny bit involved in naming some craters on Mercury. That was fun.
How did you come to do that?
Well, there is a committee that has to meet and decide what place names will be called on the different planets. If you look at a map of Mars, you will discover the most glorious nomenclature. You can go from candor to chaos in Mars in, oh, I would think a matter of hours. Or you could take a vacation in Pandora or Da Vinci. You can go to fabulous places. Somebody has to decide on those names. And I was asked at one point for the names of some lovers to be craters on Mercury, and I chose some ancient lovers, Genji and Lady Murasaki, so that they could be side by side forever.
You quote A.E. Hausman in your book as describing poetry as a human secretion. how do you view poetry?
Oh, I think that poetry is a form of inquiry. It's a way to get out and roam around the world and be a nomad and pick up your tent one day and pitch it someplace else the next day. Try to figure out all the to-ings and fro-ings of life.
The language of senses seems to revolve around one end, really, survival, either helping us to flee or to fight, or for reproduction, images, senses of to encourage sexuality and reproduction.
That is the origin, really, of all of the senses, to help us continue breeding or to protect us. So, for example, something tastes sour to us because it would be poisonous, it would be dangerous for us to eat it or to drink it. On the other hand, even though evolution has greatly guided us and probably controls us in many complicated and subtle ways that we're not aware of, we do manage now and then to sidestep evolution just for sport. So even though coffee signals a newborn baby that something is dangerous because it tastes sour, we like to drink it just as an extra novelty, or we like to eat things that are very hotly spiced. We don't always pay attention to evolution. Sometimes I think we like to stray from it just for athletic purposes. Probably the best example of that would be the fashion for eating fugu, the flesh of the puffer fish.
This is a deadly fish, isn't it?
This is a deadly fish. Its flesh contains a kind of poison that has been used in voodoo zombification ceremonies. It's very dangerous stuff. And it's considered a very high art form in Japan, the preparation of fugu, and the actual ritual of dining on the fugu. And the best fugu chefs are the ones who manage to leave in just enough of the poison that the diner's lips will tingle with the close call to that person's mortality, but the diner won't actually die.
In your research for the book, have you sampled fugu?
No, I decided not to do that. I did lots of other research things, but I thought that would be a little reckless. I passed on that. A curious thing about fugu is that it's understood that people can seem to die of fugu poisoning, but really just go into a state of paralysis and not wake up for days. people who have done that and woken up later who weren't buried reported being, appearing to be dead, but being fully aware of all of the proceedings of the funeral and desperately wishing that someone would realize they were still alive. And therefore, in Japan, if someone dies of fugu poisoning, it is legal for that person not to be buried for a few days just in case they're going to wake up.
I want to ask about the sense of smell. How specific our sense of smell can be. For instance, perfume smellers, people who develop perfume, end up working with complex and very small amounts of scent in order to create a larger scent. How sensitive is our nose to these gradations of odor?
Our nose is very, very sensitive. But of course, that depends on the person, and the sensitivity is hereditary. There is a little patch in the back of everyone's nose, which tends to be yellowish in color. If it is very deeply yellow, then you will have a much stronger sense of smell than if it happens to be very pale. So albinos tend to have a very poor sense of smell, and some people have a very robust and rich sense of smell. But having said that, of course, you can train your sense of smell in the same way that you can train any of your other senses, just by focusing on them enough, really concentrating. So someone who is a nose by profession probably has a nice genetic makeup that allows her to become a great nose, and then probably becomes a better and better nose over the years the more she does it. I talked with a woman like that in New York when I was working on the book. This is a lovely, earthy Russian woman who invents most of the famous perfumes in the world.
The ones that sell for hundreds of dollars in department stores?
Oh, yes. The ones whose names would be known in any household. She is a kind of ghostwriter. She's not allowed to tell you which perfumes she invents, but she invents most of them. She has an exquisitely sensitive nose, and she has in her offices what looks like an organ on which you would play music, but it contains a symphony of smells, and she mixes them. She knows what each one is in the same way that a composer would understand what sounds would be made by the brasses or the timpani, and she mixes them up depending on what she would like.
Some of the raw ingredients of perfume are scents from anal glands of different animals and from the guts of other creatures.
Yes.
How do you think humans first came to discover how these fragrances could work on us?
I think that's really quite a question. I mean, who was the first person who wanted to reach into the anal sac of a civet? I don't know. And having done that, who was the first person who said, I think that would make a nice perfume?
Yeah, and then rub it on yourself.
Let's rub it all over ourselves and see if we like each other better. I don't know who first invented that, but there's no doubt that such pure animal smells, if taken straight, are very repulsive and probably would make you throw up. But when just a little bit of them is added to other ingredients, we find them deeply aphrodisiac. Part of the reason is that a number of these smells are similar enough, the chemicals are similar enough to human pheromones, that they're reminiscent to us, and so we have a response. Male pig hormone is very similar to male human hormone. And so it's an ingredient in some best-selling perfumes.
Are the odors that go into perfumes the same kind of odors that would have the same effect on people all over the world, or are certain odors culture-specific?
I think the answer to that is yes and no. There are some givens with all of the senses. There are some givens in terms of music and musical response, smell, taste, all those things. But then having said that, there also are cultural preferences. If you've grown up surrounded by the smells of curry being prepared, you're probably going to love it for the rest of your life because smell is a very emotional sense. The other senses are interpreted in different parts of the brain, but smell is interpreted in the oldest part of the brain, the seat of our emotions, and therefore it's a deeply emotional sense. Nothing is more memorable than a smell. You smell something, let's say lemon, and suddenly you can be transported across time and country back perhaps 20 years to your grandmother's house where maybe she used a lemon-scented floor polish or she used to bake lemon cookies. Without a moment's hesitation, you will just be flung out of yourself and suddenly remember everything from that time.
What's the earliest memory you have of a smell?
Oh, I don't know about a smell memory. That would be hard to say. I think when I was growing up in the Midwest, and there was a plum orchard that I walked through on the way to school each day, I remember looking up. This was one of my first visual memories, too. And I saw that the plums, which were dark and rich and purple, were huddled like little bats in the trees above me. And I remember the odor, the fragrance of them.
How does taste tie in with cravings? Say a craving for chocolate. Is this a taste, a biological need for some substance in the food?
Chocolate passion is a very controversial subject right now. It fascinates me in particular because I am a dyed-in-the-wool chocoholic, as many people are. I'm persuaded from reading the research that the reason people crave chocolate is that there is a chemical in chocolate called PEA, which the body normally produces when we fall in love. It gives us an amphetamine-like rush, and we are just riding on a roller coaster. This level of the chemical drops, of course, when we fall out of love or when we've been jilted, and that may very well be why people who are suffering in that way rush home and immediately pig out on chocolate, and also why traditionally sweethearts have given chocolate to one another when they go to see them. People who argue against this say that really what chocoholics are craving is just the carbohydrate or just the sugar in it, something like that. But I think if that were true, then a cookie would do or pasta would do.
Do you have an explanation based on your own personal experience?
Well, I think that chocolate is so specific a craving, as anyone who is lying awake at 11 or 12 at night on a snowy evening saying, boy, would I love some chocolate right now, and just decides to run out to that corner store and get some, knows. It's so specific a craving that I think really it is a chemical one, and I think it's very, very likely that there is this PEA in chocolate, and that's what we're trying to replenish in our bodies when we eat it.
We use our senses in some ways to sort of fuel ourselves for some task. We might want to step outside for a breath of fresh air. We need a certain kind of light that'll help us work a little better under other circumstances. Sometimes we need to eat a food to get us going. What senses do you draw on to start your day as a writer?
Just about every morning in the summer, I go out into my yard where I have raised beds of miscellaneous flowers, and I spend a very serene, zen-like hour or so rejoicing in the colors and the smells and deciding which flowers I'm going to pick on that day. I'm untroubled by anything so awkward as thought, and I find that a lovely way to wake up in the morning.
You consider thought awkward?
If what you're doing is just enjoying the colors and the sights and the sounds of the day as it's dawning. Yes, but I've discovered in researching the book that really each of the senses is wildly important. I didn't realize when I first began working on it how important touch was. However, I went down to an intensive care ward for premature babies in Miami as part of the work on this book. And traditionally, preemies are put into little isolation booths so that they won't be tampered with in any way and that they're safe from germs. But what the scientists have been discovering of late is that if you do that with a baby, it mistakenly thinks that it's been abandoned by its mother, and it shouldn't do anything extravagant that would use up its energies, like grow, for instance. And these preemies that are put away like this in these isolation booths tend to have immune system disorders when they're older. They tend not to develop quickly enough. They have all kinds of learning problems, and they can sometimes have emotional and psychological problems. And all of that can be counteracted by having people come in regularly and massage them. It's best if it's the parents, but it can be anyone. There are volunteers, very often middle-aged men, who will come in at all hours of day and night and just regularly touch these babies. It greatly alters the course of their lives.
I'd like to shift topics here for a second. You worked once on a cattle ranch in New Mexico. What took you there?
Well, I was in my 20s. I had grown up with a passion for horses and horseback riding, as a lot of American girls do. I had always fantasized about riding out with the cowboys. One day I discovered that I was a writer and a grown-up, and I could probably do this. And so I went out to a 200,000-acre cattle ranch, a working cattle ranch in northeastern New Mexico, and I just signed on. I went there in each of its seasons so that I could herd the cattle and take part in the roping and branding and the calving, which I especially loved. And it was just fascinating to see what kinds of things were still being done on horseback, just as they were being done 100 years ago in the Old West.
A few years ago, you worked as a soccer journalist.
Yes. You know about that, huh?
What attracted you to soccer?
I was starting to write a novel about play. I wanted to learn about ceremonial violence and the history of play. And I thought that would be an interesting way to do it. I tuned into a television show, and I saw soccer taking place, a very lyrical, beautiful game, a lawn game in which men seemed to be hazing quarry towards a net. I thought it was anthropological and lyrical and very beautiful.
We sometimes often wish to heighten our senses, and we use perfumes or salt or drugs to do it, and sometimes we want to neutralize them by either drugs or climbing in sensory deprivation tanks. What is going on when we want to sort of neutralize our senses?
The world presents such a delicious whelm of experience, of sensory experience from moment to moment, that there are times when I suppose we would just like to take a nap. We sleep at night, but for some of us who are keenly aware of the world, that isn't even enough in itself, and so we do things like meditate or yes, want to tune out. But there's no way to tune out entirely. Even if you do that, you attempt to do it, you find that some other sense is taking over. You suddenly become aware of the throbbing of your heart or the rushing of your veins or the ticking of the clock. It's almost impossible to make the senses stop.
The place in which we experience a sense can determine whether it's considered pleasurable or pain that's worthwhile or pain that's torture. You refer to the experience of having your legs waxed. painful? Torture? Pleasure?
All of that. This is a modern scourging parlor, I think. I went into a very classy place in Manhattan to have my legs waxed. And it occurred to me that all you'd have to do is change the woman who was doing it from a brawny Romanian woman to a Nazi Gestapo, change the place where it was happening, but keep the level of pain identical, and we would consider this torture. We would not consider this something appropriate not to be whined or winced or screamed about in the cause of beauty.
So what does our mind do to explicate that? What does our mind do to try to shape that pain, to do it? Is it merely our own sort of justification? Is it our own free will that we're undergoing a procedure rather than somebody doing it to us?
I think that we are willing to make peace with all kinds of extremes if we believe that there is no malice, that somebody is not doing it out of any sense of cruelty, but that they actually want to come to our aid in some way.
In your book, you cover five of the known senses. Are there other senses that you feel exist?
I'm sure. It's just by convenience that we refer to five senses, but there are a great many senses that we need to spend a lot of time exploring. And I'm sure that in the coming decades, we'll do that more thoroughly.
Well, thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh, Unperfumed Air.
Thank you. The pleasure's been mine.
My guest has been Diane Ackerman. Her new book is A Natural History of the Senses. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.